constantly was, you know, on my mother's case, why I want a brother, and, you know, so on and so forth.
Until you got one.
And then all of a sudden, you know, mom's in the hospital, she comes home from the hospital, you know, with this Grace Esther wrapped up in a blanket. And she comes to the side door, it wasn't the front door, because that was only for company. And she's coming into the house with him. You know, I just looked at her. I said, he's not living here.
I think you were ignored.
Yeah, joke was on you, fella.
Yeah.
That was on South Street.
That was on South Street.
We'd already moved.
I was not born on South Street. I was born in Chapel.
You were born in the hospital. St. Joseph's.
Well, that was also in Chapel Street.
You were born in St. Joseph's or the General?
Was that, no, St. Joseph, which was on Chapel.
Exactly right.
Thank you very much.
Okay. I volunteered.
That was the Catholic hospital. The deal in Glace Bay, as it was, I mean, throughout many places, is that the Jews were divvied up. We went to the Protestant schools and the Catholic hospitals. Everybody felt they had taken care of us, you know, by that. And we weren't allowed in the play at the golf club. We had to form our own golf club, which was formed many years later.
What golf club?
Well, Lingan was the club that we couldn't play at, and Seaview, which was outside of North Sydney, was formed by...
No kidding.
Yeah.
Learn something new every day.
Yeah, and so that was, anybody could play at Seaview.
I played at the Miners Museum. They didn't have a special concert hall for Jews.
No. Music was different.
I played in the church, too. Baptist church.
You were asking more relevant questions, were you not, Eli?
You might want to guide this discussion.
I think if I'm silent, this could just keep going.
Yeah. You might want to guide this discussion, because it could be one of the more random events in the history of art.
Yeah.
I think this is as guide as things get with Cape Bretoners. Okay. I get the sense that that's the case.
Yeah.
But
I'm not sure I can be as focused as Shirley Journey.
Yeah.
My question was, the details of your birth, which are,
how long was mom in labor?
What type of information are you looking for?
I am interested.
Date.
Yeah, I'm interested.
How were you born?
I was born in February 10th, in fact, of 1949. Which, just for your listening audience, people might want to know that in just a very few days, I am turning 65, and will become a senior.
Yeah, it's 4 days from now.
Yes.
Or less.
I mean, it may be of no consequence.
That's a big deal
for
him.
Yeah. Junior here, though, was born 6 years later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm still 6 years younger. I personally was born on June the 14th, 1955.
Mm-hmm. That's 6 years.
Actually, 6 years and several months later than my older brother.
Yeah.
I also was born at St. Joseph's Hospital.
All Jews.
Of course, when I went back to volunteer there, they recognized me.
You look the same as the day you were born.
Yeah.
I maintained my youth.
Mm-hmm. You still have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, except for the hair.
I didn't say nothing.
Leaving you out of this for a brief moment.
Yes, no problem.
That's fine by me.
Stay tuned.
Yeah.
The first house that you were in.
Yes.
On Chapel.
Yeah. Chapel Hill.
It's much smaller.
Yes.
Much smaller.
Very much
smaller.
Tell
me about it.
On a hill.
I've never heard of it before.
Oh.
Well,
this is a sweet little thing.
It was like a box house, a starter house, if you will. The way mom and dad operated, you didn't buy anything until you could pay for it. I don't mean a down payment. I mean
totally.
So whether that be a house or a car, that was clearly dad's way without any ifs, no buts. And so therefore, until, I guess,
1954.
Right, 5 years old. Really, there's not much, because I wasn't going to school at that point. So I had no particular connection to Chapel Hill. I don't even remember.
How far was it from the store? Maybe a quarter of a mile?
Well, half a mile at most. It happened to be up, down the street, rather, from our family doctor. Dr. Joey McDonald.
Yeah, good friend of yours.
A good friend of mine, and even a better friend of mom's. I won't go into the fact that he drank a little bit, and that he was...
Anybody who had to look after you was driven to the drink.
Yeah. in this day and age, he would have been.
This is the boy who went to Boston to get his tonsils out, and he ran away from the hospital.
I tried. I didn't get out. But as far as Dr. Joe A. is concerned, this was already by the time we were living on South Street. I wasn't feeling well, and Mother then, not exactly at my request, indicated she was calling Dr. Joe A. Dr. Joe A. arrives, it was a stomach issue, and he just like that, you know, announced, I mean, insofar as anybody can announce after having as many drinks as he had, but he announced that he needed to have an emergency appendectomy.
What about you?
So, I, there's only so much I can do about it other than going into the bathroom and locking the door until they had to break the door down. And they took me to the hospital. That again being.
Well, you didn't need an appendectomy.
No,
you've never had one.
Well, that's correct. So we get to the hospital, and thank goodness, I forget the doctor's name.
Well, it was probably, what's his name?
Thompson?
McNeil.
Navy.
He's a good surgeon.
Okay, probably. So he comes in. This is, I'm already set out, you know.
Like a fish being filleted.
Right. And he looks at me and
says, you can go.
He says, yeah, get out of here. You got a sore stomach. You don't have an appendix problem. And this was the beginning of the end, I think, of Mum beginning to realize that Dr. Joe A.
Went on for a lot longer than that.
It did. All right. But you know what? We digress. Or he does anyway.
We got rid of Joe A.
Yeah.
Dad had his heart attack.
Uh-huh.
And
what year was that?
I'll tell you. Hang on. I was 17. I was maybe 16 to going on 17. I was in grade 10.
16 going on 17, just like
in
Sound
of
Music.
Yeah.
1972?
Around that.
Yeah.
I had just come back from Halifax. It was a Saturday night. I'd just come back from a cello lesson in Halifax. Quite late at night, maybe 11:30, 12, maybe 1 in the morning, actually. Dad woke up, our dad, woke up not well, had chest pain. Mom called Joe A. He said, take him to the emergency room. Now, Grandpa, if you think Uncle Simon doesn't like doctors, Grandpa would have nothing to do with them. He didn't like them.
Anti-Semites.
And so Mom knew that just saying to Dad, you got to go to the emergency room. Also, by the way, he was kneeling on the floor with chest pain. He was not exactly in a situation where you could just say, let's go to the emergency room together. So Mom called. No, this is not right. This is not right. Actually, it was before that. This occurred. We did not see Joe A. after I developed appendicitis. That was it. I developed appendicitis. I was sick at home in bed.
How old?
I was maybe 10, 9. And Mom called Dr. McDonald, and he said, take him to the emergency room. And I guess I looked such that Mom said, that's the wrong answer. And she called another doctor called Dr. Wax. It was a Jamaican doctor who had arrived in Glace Bay maybe a year before. And he came to our house. And looked and took me to the hospital, and I did in fact have appendicitis and my appendix out. That was the end of Joey. Yeah, he didn't look after our family anymore. Mom lost confidence in his judgment.
And Dr. Wax became the family
doctor. Dr. Wax was the family doctor, but Dad didn't really care for Dr. Wax. So when our dad had his heart attack, Mom knew there was no way Dr. Wax could handle it, so she called Dr. Khalifa, who she knew through the symphony, because the Khalifas, he and his wife, were supportive of the arts, and so Mom was very involved in concerts in Cape Breton, organizing.
He was from India.
Yeah, he was Indian. He
East
came
East
right
Indian.
To the house.
East Indian.
Yeah,
not
East
West
Indian. Indian. Yeah, he came right to the house, took Grandpa. In the car. Grandpa threw up all over the front seat because he was really not well. And he just basically looked after Grandpa at the hospital until they got him to Sydney. got him in the intensive care unit, and Grandpa said Khalifa was the only doctor he ever had time for, because he figured that Khalifa had saved his life. Well, it could be true. Anyway,
many doctors would have or could have
saved his life.
It just so happened that it
was
Khalifa.
In the town of Glace Bay, that's be an open issue as to. Like, call Jimmy Tompkins?
No,
I don't think
you
so.
You don't think so? All
no,
right.
No,
but I mean, I'm not involved with slandering doctors. I think if no one wants to do that, that's entirely his prerogative.
Who's Jimmy Tompkins?
So, in the town of Glace Bay, we had a sort of group of what are called the very established physicians. And there was a bunch of them. You know, there was like maybe half a dozen of them for a town.
Half a dozen?
Maybe more.
Maybe less.
Maybe less. These guys saw patients in the gazillions, okay? Now, for example, J.R. McNeil,
yeah,
who was a surgeon, had a terrific reputation. And I found, you know, and I also, when I went to Halifax to study medicine, I heard about this. You know, you'd hear about who the great doctors were in the community and the ones who were not so great. J.R. McNeil had a terrific reputation. Jimmy Tompkins was another one, same sort of age. Didn't have such a great reputation. Wasn't very careful. Well, there was Arthur Green. There was a bunch of them.
Arthur Green?
Yeah.
In my day?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah. So there were, there was, you know, and then...
and two dentists.
As time went on, you know, a newer generation of doctors, and many, and almost all of them were from East India that arrived, or Jamaica. So Cecil Watts was Jamaican. He was good. There was a guy named Chattopadhyay who was good. He
and
was
some
smart.
Would stay for a long time, some
and
would
some
stay,
would
for, a
stay
short
for a short time. Yeah. They were all busier than heck because there were a lot of people. There was a lot of people, and also there was a lot of illness. You know, some because we were in the mining territory, there's a lot of men with lung disease. So there was a lot, there was plenty to do. And there was 25,000 people in the town of Glace Bay. So these guys were busy. Yeah. And yeah, and there were two hospitals and that's who they were.
Aside from the fact that you went into medicine, Dad.
Mm.
I find it interesting that we get into a conversation about people who are really in services that everyone needs. You have to go to the doctor, you have to go to the dentist. Is this the kind of, well, you would think you'd have to go to the doctor, the dentist. Is there, was this sort of the primary point of access between the Jewish community and other communities?
No, not at all. We had tons to do with each other.
Okay.
But first of all, we went to school together.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're in Protestant schools. So we were in the Protestant schools. And, of course, you know, until, so in my time, until I got to grade 8, there were maybe two Jewish kids in my class. One or two.
What school was that?
So I was at, started at South Street School, which was like, I don't know. A
couple hundred kids.
You know, 50 houses down the street, 25 houses down the street. Okay, very close.
Yeah, just for primary.
Yeah, so, no.
Well, I meant
primary,
you know,
to grade
three. Four. Of three.
Yeah,
four.
Primary to grade 3, inclusive. Then I went farther to what was called Brookside School, which happened to be on Brookside Street. And so, you know, more catchment area, new kids, but no new Jewish kids. Okay?
No.
It turned out. And then for grade 8, I went to Central School. That's where I met a lot. Well, I already knew them, but that's where more Jewish kids joined. Because in my class, by the time I got to high school, of 110 students in my class in junior high and high school, in my age, in grade, there were 110 or 120 kids, and 10 of us were Jewish. It was one of the largest cohorts and the last big cohort.
Much bigger than mine. So
yeah.
Mine might have been 5.
Yeah.
Same, out of the same population base, about 110, 120,
yeah,
whatever. So,
you were at the same schools?
Yeah, well, exactly.
Yeah, basically, we marched through the same schools, just 6 years.
You had no other alternatives.
Yeah. And then from Central School, I went to Morrison Junior High School for grade 9.
Just 9.
Just 9. And then across the street into the high school for 10, 11, and 12. And then you're done.
Well, I didn't do 12, so I was done.
Yeah, he went. So he went to university after grade 11, which you could do. I had planned to do the same thing. When Dad had his heart attack, Mom turned to me and said, "You're not going to university after grade 11.
Well, you couldn't go to Dalhousie after 11.
No, you can go to SMU, though.
That's right.
So, anyway, Grandma just said, "No, you can't do that. You know, things are a little too crazy around here." So, anyway, it's fine. I mean, it was never a big issue with me. But that was the school system. Now, in parallel, there were Catholic schools. Okay? Now, we didn't... I mean, I knew almost nobody from the Catholic schools, except there were kids in my neighborhood that I played with who went to the Catholic schools.
Not too many, though.
A few.
A few.
Just a few.
Yeah, because mostly, you know, people choose where they're living based upon where their school is and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and they lived at the other end of town.
Exactly.
Yeah, so, but there were a couple. And then I used to take, for example, I took private French lessons. And I found myself getting to know some of the Catholic kids who came for those, and in a small group.
French wasn't available at school?
It was, but it wasn't taught very well, so Grandma thought it would be a good idea if I took extra French lessons, it was fine with me, so I did that. And then through the music, I played in recitals. I mean, I started piano when I was in grade 9. And through that, I would mix occasionally with some of the other kids, but not very much. And I guess the only other place that we'd meet people, I feel like I would meet people that I didn't know, was at the store.
Yeah. Okay. But we weren't meeting people of our generation.
No.
Yeah,
other people.
You're just meeting other people.
Other people that, like, I wouldn't know the family, and then I'd be told, well, they go to... up to, what was the Catholic high school?
St.
Mike's High School. So, that's a Catholic family. The kids go to St. Mike's.
Yeah. So you got to remember.
You know, some of the people who worked in our store were Catholic.
Right. You know, Mary Guthrie. Yeah. I mean, small town, okay? So, you know, it's a little bit beyond comprehension. It's not intuitive in any way that, you know, you'd live in the same town, and yet there'd be it's half the town, or close to it, I don't know what the demographics exactly were in the breakdown, that you would never see. The contact would be very incidental.
Now, so, mind you, it was not a small town.
Well, 25,000.
There were 25,000
people.
Okay,
that's still, I mean, compared to people living in cities, it's still pretty small. You know, so for example, someone who's now a friend of mine, song composer, Alistair McGilvery, Alistair Catholic, her paths never ever crossed, as kids.
Yeah.
He says that we were once on the television program Reach for the Top together.
Oh,
cool. I'm sure he says I'm sure he's right. Hmm. But, that was,
What's Reach for the Top?
It was a quiz program for high school.
Quiz program.
But.
How'd you do?
He was good.
Yeah.
I was terrible. I was on it too.
But
the same time.
I would meet Catholic kids in a different way, through sports.
Yeah.
Okay, in a very oppositional way. I mean, you were playing against the Catholic schools. That this was at a time before 1960. I think it was 1960 where you had the big 62, the papal encyclical, which finally removed the stigma that Jews quote killed Christ. So, the amount of anti-Semitism in the Catholic community up in till that point in time, and a few years after, because news traveled slowly to Cape Breton, was much higher than it was in the Protestant community. Now, I'm not trying to suggest in any way that there was no anti-Semitism in the Protestant community. I mean, they did have their fair share, and maybe a little more than that.
Yeah.
But it was still in comparison. So when I played on 4 or 5 different high school sports, so I'd be meeting up in games. I remember going to New Waterford. Mm. and playing against the Catholic high school in New Waterford, Mount Carmel. And so this must have been fairly late in the game because I was only put in the game if we were 10 points up or 10 points behind, since I was seen as a little bit of a liability.
Was this basketball?
This was basketball. So I was going up for a layup, and as I'm going up for a layup, this player who's trying to catch up to me from Mount Carmel, you know, make some remark, you know, about a dirty Jew, and he had an F word thrown in there just to be polite.
It was not Fox.
It wasn't, no. And so instead of going up and just putting up the layup, I turned around and I just shoved the basketball in, you know, in his face.
Did you get a foul for that?
And I got kicked out of the game for that, and I complained, of course, that the unsportsmanlike behavior of being called, you know, such a name. Mm. And you know, the boys will be boys, you know. What can you do? But I had taken it too far, obviously. But no, what I meant as far as they were concerned.
Oh.
Now, no matter what sports I was playing, the fact, and not that, wasn't the only Jewish boy who played a lot of sports. There were a few others, but it wasn't a common thing. So that you stood out. It was not unusual, you know, like, for instance, I played a lot of hockey. And up until a certain point in time, to grade 10 or something like that, I had a certain ability, if one wants to put that in quotations, of being able to tip in pucks. I knew I could figure out the angles of pucks and was able to tip it. Well, I scored a lot of goals. Now, even amongst my teammates, this was not a popular thing because they were not seen as skillful. You know, this was not somebody stick handling and taking a great shot or whatever. So it was seen as very much, you know, the effing Jew, you know, stealing a goal, like as if I didn't have tipped.
You're like
it
a banker or a money lender.
Right. If I hadn't tipped the puck, somebody else, it would have been somebody else's goal, and not, but I stole their goal and whatever. And then, of course, because I'm hanging around the goal crease, the other teams would be yelling at their defenseman, the goalie would be yelling at their defenseman, get that effing Jew out of here. And especially after, say, grade 10, I didn't become, even though I was tall, I was not at all bulky. That would be an understatement. And of course, their defensemen would be able to muscle me out of there. But it was always the effing Jew as opposed to get that, you know, player out of here, and so on and so forth. So, especially for boys, I think, as boys, and especially for boys who played sports, you saw, let us say, the rougher edges of the community, that you could, I'm sure, especially for girls, you could grow up in Glace Bay and have a perfectly, you know, normal, quote, normal life as a Jewish young woman and not be exposed in the same way. There would be a quiet anti-Semitism, but you wouldn't be exposed to it on a regular basis. But that's not to say it wasn't there and in their homes. You had to be in certain settings to become more exposed to it. And I had that, you know, for better or worse, that opportunity to see, you know, some pretty ugly stuff. Could be playing Little League Baseball. I won't mention his name, but I remember this pitcher. I still remember his name. You know, he had the biggest fastball. And I'd get up to the plate, and he would, you know, yell out, you know, across the field towards me at the plate, "This one's coming at you, you effing Jew." This was common coin. It was not all that unusual to be chased home by some,
yeah,
because the distance from our school to where we lived crossed an area that had some rougher
or
elements.
Or a road.
Right, or Water Street. And
what was rough about that?
They were rough names.
Yeah, they had some.
They were rough families.
Rough families, yeah.
What were the families involved in?
They were
miners.
No,
workmen.
Workmen. I mean,
workmen are not very educated.
Right.
Rough.
Yeah.
But going to the same school.
Absolutely.
Oh,
well, they had no choice.
No choice.
Yeah. Now, I don't want to say that everybody who lived on Water Street was like that. You know, that wasn't true.
Some of them were.
But you had an element, and you know, one had to cross, because we generally always went home for lunch, okay?
Always,
yeah. So you had to cross certain hurdles on your way often, not on a daily basis, but definitely on a weekly basis. You could become a little paranoid. You know, for instance, the next door neighbors to us were perfectly lovely people. They had a boxer dog. I was convinced this dog was an anti-Semite because he barked at me.
Yeah, well, some people are a little paranoid, but yeah. That's okay. This would take various forms. Halloween, swastika on the sidewalk in front of our house. Okay?
With some regularity.
Oh, very regular in my day.
Yeah.
Grandpa would never allow me to wash it off. His view was let them choke on it, that Jews live there. Another example, just crazy stuff that would happen. Senator Robert Kennedy was assassinated in 1968. Okay, June 1968. A phone call to our house. A Jew killed Kennedy. We're going to get you. I was taken to school and driven home for about 4 days by the police. Okay, and I was not allowed out for recess until they found out who did this. And then it was fine. I don't know what they did about this guy. But anyway, it was a fellow classmate who did it.
Yeah, but it was Jack Ruby who killed Kennedy. But
that's not true.
And Oswald, rather.
Excuse me. Oswald? We're talking about Robert Kennedy.
Jack Kennedy would have been 1960.
Yeah, it was Shiran Saran. Yes. He was a Jordanian Arab, right. Which is what I said on the phone. I said, you fool. I says, Jordanian Arab. Not yeah. that matters.
No.
But you're a stupid idiot. It's not a Jewish person.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, but that was...
Unfortunately, I didn't think much of it. Unfortunately, Grandma was on the other line listening. She didn't like this.
No.
Got quite worried about it. Okay. Thus the police. All right. So stuff like that would happen. But I think... In general terms, I had less of it than Simon did.
Because times changed.
Even though I had some of it. Yeah.
Times changed, and also we associated.
Yeah, he hung around with a bunch of roughnecks. I did. I was with a more cultured group.
That's right.
But more musical people.
But there's no question, as time went on, now you also have to remember another factor, sociological factor, if you will, is that in single industry towns, I don't care where they are, basically. The historic patrons were Jews were often not the sole merchants of the town, but they were, you know, they were clearly way beyond any normal expectations. If on Commercial Street in Glace Bay, were 15 stores, you know, 10 of them would be Jewish,
yeah,
okay?
Plenty.
So, and this happened in loads and loads of places.
Of that generation, though.
That's right.
Right, because these were immigrants, and this is what the class they came from.
Right.
So, you know, it all sort of fit together.
So, therefore,
wouldn't
people would see, so many, Jewish stores.
They'd think
who's running the economy? The Jews. The fact that the banks were all anti-Semitic in those days and no Jews could work in the banks and any happened.
Didn't matter,
or the big chain stores so on and so forth. So, there was... It was a ton of anti-Semitism that just came, quote unquote, naturally by virtue of who they thought
stereotypes
was in control.
Yeah,
and you could go all through different places in Canada. I happened to live much later in Sudbury, Ontario, which was a single industry town by and large.
Same
phenomena, less so because there were less Jewish merchants. Because Jewish merchants were a one or two generation phenomena. Because in our case, and this would be in so many other, almost all cases, the sons and daughters were not encouraged.
Not interested.
Were not interested, nor were they likely to be encouraged to stay and to look after the business.
So at no point did Grandpa ever say
no.
Oh, precisely the opposite.
Oh, no. He had no interest in that.
Yeah.
Had no expectation. No. Like most families. They wanted us to become extremely well educated and move on.
They didn't want you to live.
No.
In Glace Bay?
No, God, no.
No. No.
In fact, they wanted to get out of there as quickly as they could themselves.
Yeah.
You know, Grandma and Grandpa contemplated moving to Vancouver. They almost did.
Yeah.
When would that have been?
Oh.
When you were in high school?
You were young.
Yeah. This would be Simon
would have been young.
Still in the 50s or early 60s, something like that?
Yeah.
There was the real serious thought to that.
Yeah.
Didn't happen.
What would they do?
Oh,
Dad was going to open a business.
That was pure and simple.
He was going to open a business.
And he could in those days, this is before all the big chain stores and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
If you had talent as he did, you know, to know how to buy and sell, you could open a business almost anywhere.
Anyway, they didn't do it, but anyway.
Climate was a big part of the reason why they wanted to go.
Yeah. Anyway, they decided not to.
So let's talk about the store.
Okay.
Let's start from the top.
I never wore any of the clothes, did you?
Not that I want to talk about.
Yeah. Maybe
cross-dressing was just not something that was in vogue at that time.
That's
you
where
were a cross-dresser in Glace Bay.
Yeah.
Well, that's where we're in line with Rob Ford.
That's right. No.
What you do in your home is your business.
That's
but
right.
This idea of running buck naked down the street,
it's
as
fine.
Doug says, it's not really.
Or
okay.
Dennis Rodman or any of that stuff. That's not us. That's just,
not okay.
No. Never was.
No. The store was a very busy store. It was a landmark. People said it was a landmark.
It became one,
Yeah, I mean, it was... Grandpa was a very talented businessman. There were one, two other ladies' wear stores in Glace Bay.
That's correct.
All owned by Jewish people.
And they were?
They were the Rukashans and the Marshalls. They sold mixed goods, meaning men's and women's, and also different ages. Like, they could go into, like, you could buy child wear there. Okay, child clothing. But, so, Rukasin's was ladies' wear. You know, Rosenblum's, ladies' wear.
Okay.
Marshall's mixed.
The only thing that, remember, there was more worse than the Met. Now, they did sell some clothes as well. And there was Sears. You could buy from the catalog. They had a catalog store. So... So I don't know again, how it all divvied up. Let us just say Rosenblum's ladies wear
sort of dominant
was a very I mean, it's conceivable it had half of the market.
I don't know what it did, but it was sure on everybody's lips.
Yeah.
It had a big clientele.
Yeah, not just from Glace Bay.
No, so that's the other thing is that in Waterford there was a big ladies wear store. That was Schwartz's, and in Sydney there was what's his name.
Weber.
It was called the Smart Shop.
Yeah.
I'm sure there were others too.
And Dad's brother had a store in Sydney as
that's
well.
True. Yeah, that was not a very strong business.
No, but it was a ladies' wear store.
Which brother's that?
Max. He was not as talented a businessman.
Well, they were partners at one time.
Yeah, but not in
in my time.
Yeah,
not in your time.
Yeah, I don't have much memory of that.
Yeah.
So. So I would say around the store, first of all, service was everything. So you walked in that store, so you'd either like it or you wouldn't. You walk in the store, there'd be women standing around, the sales ladies, and you couldn't go very far before they would come up to you and ask you how they can help you.
And
okay.
If they didn't, Dad would be clearly...
Dad would want them... Dad would want that kind of customer out.
Yeah. He did not want
anybody
casual browsing.
No.
You couldn't say to a salesperson or to Dad, just browsing.
Just looking.
No, doesn't
forget
work.
It.
No. Didn't want that customer.
Yeah, and he hated adolescents.
He did.
Girls. Because they were real browsers. Yeah. And he just hated that kind of customer. And didn't have too many of them, unless they were taken by their mothers, okay, to the store. But he had plenty of women who really appreciated the service, because the sales ladies in the store were very talented. They knew what they were doing. They were really good. And so they would wait on these people hand and foot. And then, of course, you had, it was a credit business, which Grandpa was one of the earliest people to do that, because, before that, you had to pay. But he started a credit business.
People would pay so much a week on their own.
Yeah. And there's decades where he'd sit in the house every Sunday or on Wednesday afternoon and enter those entries into the books of what they bought and what they paid.
And establish
all done by him.
What the limits were.
Yeah.
Different customers based
allowed
on how they paid, how much they could, what their credit limit was.
Yeah.
This wasn't scientific, it was intuitive on his part, and he incredibly successful.
Right.
Because if things didn't work out, you had to sell that part of your book to a credit company who would take a good chunk, and then they would chase them down legally and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Dad did do business with these credit companies,
but not a lot.
But it wasn't much because he was so careful. Nevertheless, he could not have been the success he was unless he was a credit business.
Yeah, yeah, and he knew that.
Yeah,
expanded out. So the service was big. All the tailoring was done in the store and very quickly. So there were upstairs dressmakers, and you know what you needed, you got, and you didn't pay for it. So that was big in those days.
Very big.
Okay? It was a big deal. Women knew they got ultra service. Then, of course, I can see him so many times. He had many women who customers for a long time. They had particular tastes. They were looking for particular things. You could hear him on the phone to the factories in Montreal and Toronto. I need a coat. I need a dress. It's got to look like this. This is what I want. And I got to have it
tomorrow.
All right? Ship it. Okay? Don't tell me next week. Tomorrow. You know, this is the kind of, and of course the women appreciate this because he was looking after them.
And he hit the clout with the factories.
Yeah, because he had.
Because he bought much big. More than anybody else on the island bought.
Yeah.
So he was able to, you know, pull rank, if you will.
Yeah.
And also, you know, I mean, it would be illegal today in terms of, I mean, but out of, in terms of
competition
laws. But he would be able to say to the factories, you know, I'm going to be the only person on Cape Breton Island selling that good. Or at least I'm going to be the only one in Glace Bay. Don't even think of selling that line to anybody else.
And they would say, what are you talking about? We can't do that. He said, well, then fine. You know what? I'm not doing business with you anymore. And of course, they would change their tune immediately.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
But he was a hard-nosed businessman. He was really hard-nosed.
Yeah.
There was no caving in for Grandpa. He negotiated them. Really tough, okay? So I'd say that was another big one. And then the other thing was the sales.
Twice a year.
That was unbelievable to watch. So what would happen was everybody knew that early in July.
It was the same time every year. Yeah. Well, a day, basically.
Early in the new year.
Yeah.
Like, you know, very soon after New Year's, there would be a sale. What would happen was everything in the store was 50 off. 50%.
Yeah, and that was very unusual in those days.
Very.
Okay?
This like today. You know, you get 25% off, 10% off, all this stuff. Dad, Grandpa, just knock everything 50%.
It went, yeah, there were no gradations like the, in today's world, off-price retailing and so on and so forth. You know, there's all sorts of variants. It was very simple with that. You know,
clearly.
It moved. Once it was going on sale, you know, he did not want that... That inventory, he couldn't. Yeah, you know, there was a logistical problem on space in the store.
Yeah,
you know, he had to have
that
closet.
Yeah, he'd have stuff
space.
Upstairs. He'd have upstairs. He'd have some goods that were waiting to come in for the new season. Okay, that wouldn't go on sale, of course. You know, it was. But he knew he had to clear that place out because soon after the sale, all kinds of goods were going to come in.
Yeah. But it wasn't just clearing out his existing inventory. You know, he did enough business with the factories. And with the company
stuff in.
That he would be calling them up, you know, a month before the sale and say, okay, what do you have, you know, that
I can sell
at this price, and of course everybody had to share in that cost cutting, but you know they also coming to the end of a season had to clear goods.
Yeah.
It was a virtuous circle, if you will. I mean, everybody benefited by this. But the lineups.
Oh, yeah. So
by 7 o'clock in the morning after a 9 o'clock opening.
Yeah, yeah. So that would be the funny thing. So what would happen? I can see him preparing the ads for the newspaper. Okay. And also preparing the sign on the window. Okay. There was nothing professional about any of this. Okay. Particularly the stuff on the windows. Okay. So what would happen was he'd put up a piece of paper.
Sale.
And he would say sale. And as soon as that went up, the word would go out.
Yeah.
Okay. Like fire. Okay, and then the next morning at 7 a.m., we would, you know, so in your day, I guess you, but I certainly remember from certainly high school, is I would appear at about 8 o'clock in the morning at the store, and I would have to get through these women to get in the front door of the store. And the store front was quite narrow, okay? You had big windows, and then you have a little walkway, and then you had a whole other set of windows. And they would be so thick that I'd have to, you know, please, can I get through? And then people wouldn't know who we were. So, you know, and get in, and then I'd knock on the door, and Dad would come and let me in. Of course, they
and we were
dying
to run the
in.
Cash register.
Yeah,
we,
that
we
was got, our role.
That was our role.
Yeah. Dad would have two cash registers he would set up. We'd take one of us, and he wouldn't take one. Somebody else, Mom, would be in there, okay? Grandma. Okay, he would be prowling, watching, doing whatever was necessary, because stuff was shifting in the store all the time, because there's so many people. The place was packed, okay? I can see it at the end of a day. Like, the end of a day. Like, I might work the morning when it was intense. Then I go to school. He would say, okay, you go, okay? Because it would start to lay off a bit around noon or something. Then I come back, you know, help clean the store, help this, whatever it was. So I'm back in the store around 5:30, something like that. I'd walk in the front door, and I'd say, hi. And I'd hear, hi, 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 hi. It's echoes. The showcases, we had these, the store had what were called showcases. So basically, it's where the stuff was hanging. But it was protected. It was like in a boxed area. Okay? Some stuff was out right on the floor, but a lot of it was in showcase.
In wardrobes.
So the sounds used to echo through this stuff when the place was empty. It was hilarious. You'd walk in the place, and within 48 hours, there wasn't a lot left. So, and then, you know, here we go. All over again.
New goods. Yeah.
New goods.
Ready to go.
And so on. But those sales were hilarious. And I used to get a big kick out of it. Because, well, in the beginning, I wasn't at the cash register. In the beginning, like even as a 16-year-old, I was controlling the door. Because there were so many people that Dad would tell me, you can let in 10 people or 15, count 15 people. Okay? But until people started leaving, you could not let more people in. It would have become crazy.
Well, we had a couple of cases where they, you know, through the pressure
yeah.
of the people, the windows broke.
Yeah, the windows broke.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a big pane of windows.
Yeah.
But they were just going. And, of course, some of these people were my teachers. Because most of the teachers in the school were women. Not all, but most. And they would take the day off. And so it was pretty funny. I'd be standing there and nose to nose with one of my teachers who was looking at me as if to say, let me in. And I'd say, I can't yet. Yeah, I mean, it was pretty funny. These are comical moments.
Now, of course, most of these customers had scoped out the merchandise
yeah. Oh, yeah.
in the last two
Didn't
or three
work.
Days. Because everybody knew. Dad sort of mixed it up a little bit. There would be a variation of a day.
He
didn't want total predictability of that on this day the sale began. But, you know, you could figure it out within 2 or 3 day period. It was, you know, it didn't take a genius.
Yeah, but look what he did with the merchandise.
Right.
He used to shuffle the merchandise. Just for laughs.
Yeah.
He did not like that women would come in and case the joint.
Yeah.
And so what he would do is move it around.
So they couldn't predict exactly
yeah.
what was going
to It be. Was hilarious. I'd watch him. He'd take dresses that he knew were always there. He'd take it and throw it over there.
Yeah. Now,
it's very funny. It's very funny.
Mentioning the dressmaking, okay, which was upstairs. Not only, you know, it was dressmaking free, but it was delivered to you. Okay?
Oh, yeah.
So, I turned 16, and I go for my driver's test. And let us just say that I failed the first time. I failed the second time. I even failed the third time.
Did you really?
Yes.
Yeah, good job. Got a hat trick.
Yeah. So, it comes to the fourth time, and I take, you know, the test. And, of course, in small town, Dad's waiting for me as the examiner, you know, we come back in the car and he turns to everybody, knows everybody, and he says, Arthur, I'm giving Simon his license, but if I were you, I wouldn't let him drive. Well, of course, that wasn't in the cards at all because I was needed to drive.
Deliveries.
You know, just to take stuff from upstairs.
Yeah.
You know, especially on weekends,
right.
You know, you'd be doing the rounds, bringing stuff.
I remember. I can just see it. A dress came in from out of town that obviously Grandpa had ordered. And he said to me, you know, when I was a similar age and I could drive. By the way.
He did get it on his first
time. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was not as high achiever as you were.
Yeah.
And so he says, Norman, take this dress to so-and-so in a dress. In a box. You know, it was in a box. So I go to the front door and people knew who I was and I thank you very much. I appreciate it. I'm sure, you know, that it'll look terrific on my mother. Okay? This is a woman of, like, grandma's age at that point. I said, well, that's good. I'm glad. You know, thank you. Bye. So I go back to the store. I say, well, it's good. You know, did you deliver it? Yep. Good. She said, I'm sure it'll look great on my mother. Dad. Grandpa laughs. He sort of laughs and he says, well, that's good because she's dead. And it was my introduction to the idea, because I had no idea that in the non-Jewish world, they actually dressed up the body when they buried it. Is that mirror?
Yep.
Yeah.
Hey.
It was hilarious. I had no idea about this stuff. And so that was part of it. He used to bring it, get close, ready, for the families where somebody was dead. That was another little fun. So the store was a real piece of action. It was next to the town hall on McKean Street. So the town hall was a landmark. It was a very old building. The store was also very old.
And the town hall also had the police.
Yes. So the jail was in the basement of the town hall. Actually, Grandpa took me down there for a tour of the... so the head of police in those days was a guy who was a really nice guy named Mark Gardner. And when I was a little boy, he took me into the police station. Dad, because, you know, little boys are fascinated with police and stuff. So he took me in, and Mark took me down to the jail, and Dad was with Mark. And then Mark, he said, you know, you want to go in the cell? And then I went in the cell, and they locked the door. It was funny.
You had to be
hey!
There. Taping.
That's fine. We'll take
we
break.
Are taping.
Oh, yeah. You have to be very, very quiet.
Yeah, don't.
It's
yeah.
Okay, keep going.
No, kidding.
There's been like an old-timey radio routine.
That's adorable.
So, we were well fed, though.
Yeah.
Good.
Have some ribs.
There's none. No, don't eat my ribs.
No,
good bones left.
Do you want a text?
Huh?
Do you want a text?
No, what's up?
Okay. How's
my... Do you want food? Freezer pierogies. You guys
want to
take a 5-minute break, something like that?
Why not?
Sure, sure.
Why not?
Yeah, we're exhausted.
Yeah. And we haven't got that much else.